Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to episode 29 of Someone Who Isn't Me. The guest on Swim this time is Michael Burkitt, who's better known as Fat Mike from NoFX, but he also does Cokie the Clown, he runs Fat Records, and a bunch of other stuff, actually. Normally, with Swim, I'm generally on pretty good terms with the guests before we start, but with this one, I think I'd only ever met Mike once before, and it was really briefly in a shuttle bus between stages at Download Festival once, and we shared a couple of words, and that was that. So I was, you know, I didn't know how it was going to go. I turned up at their dressing room at Slam Dunk, and we started doing the interview, but the thing was, they were kind of in the middle of something when I walked in. Him and his mate Baz, who, if you're a NoFX fan, you probably know that there was an orchestral version of The Decline put online a while ago, where a guy, a music student, took their song and reworked it as a symphony, and it went up online and stuff. So when I went to do the interview, Mike and this guy Baz were working on a version of The Decline for an upcoming show. When we start talking about it straight away, and then Mike said, oh, this isn't in the interview. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then he said, but it could be. So as far as mixed messages go, that's pretty mixed. So I wasn't really sure what was going to happen. And I did text him the other day, and I was like, hey, man, do you want me to leave this bit in at the start? And he said, I don't even remember. So I have left it in. But I have actually censored yes with a proper bleep and everything. I censored out the date and the place that they're doing this show, because it would have been a spoiler otherwise, and it hasn't been announced, so I didn't want to be that guy. The conversation, I think, as we started it, is actually really good, so, and I found it really interesting myself, so I've left it in, but I have taken out the, the date and the place and everything. Mike's obviously known for being very outspoken, which I think has probably bitten him on the arse a few times. Most recently, when NoFX were playing in Las Vegas, I think it was like 8 months after the shooting that happened at the Country Music Festival, Harvest Festival, I think it was. And there was some onstage banter that was in pretty poor taste, and it really did backfire on him. There were repercussions, and the media got hold of it, and ended up with Mike getting dragged. And yeah, what was said was in poor taste, but it wasn't necessarily just him that said stuff. If anything, I think he was trying to kind of do damage limitation. But all the focus of all the negativity was obviously on him. So we spoke a little bit about that, but I didn't really want to get into it too much, because there'd been all the stuff online about it. He'd made his apologies, and I figured we'd just talk about some other things without getting into it, because I thought enough had been said about it already. And that wasn't me, like, you know, kind of swerving round it or ignoring the fact that it happened, because we do talk about it a little bit at the end, and they're definitely not making apologies for anything, because, you know, things get said on stage and can be very off the cuff with very little thought for the actual consequences or the people involved. And I think it was one of those situations. It definitely wasn't done out of like malicious intent. But yeah, anyways, we did talk a lot about the Cokie the Clown record, which is called You're Welcome, which he put out recently. And that was the reason I wanted to speak to him, because I think the record is fantastic. It's a very beautiful, very honest and very miserable record. All the songs are sung very openly and honestly. There's one song on there called That Time I Killed My Mum, about when his mum was terminally ill. And it's a super bum out, but at the same time, really beautiful. The other song which really struck me was a song called Swing and Miss, Swing and a Miss, which is about one of his friend's suicides. And like I said, the record is a total bum out. It's really miserable, but at the same time, it's an amazing work of art. It's definitely worth listening to. I've played it to a bunch of people and shown the videos to people. Well, we talk about that a little bit as well. So yeah, we spoke about that. I know as well that Mike is heavily into the BDSM scene, which is something I didn't really know about. And I think the best way of finding out other people's perspectives is to sit down and speak to people that are in that world, or any world, you know. If there's something you find kind of intriguing, for whatever reason, and you know nothing about it, and you know somebody that's super into it, it's cool to actually sit and have a conversation with them about it, which I find fascinating. I think the fact that he talks so openly about that stuff, as well as everything else, just shows that he's a very smart, open, and honest guy. I found it a really good conversation. I hope you do too. This is Fat Mike.
If you don't want to do it now, I don't want to be... If you're in the middle of it, I don't want to be the guy that's...
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Because what happens is we put our ideas down, and but some of the timing's wrong, and he knows what he has to change. He's doing all his changes now.
Okay. So when's it got to be done? By?
Tonight. Well, because he's... This isn't in the interview.
This isn't?
No.
Okay.
But it could be.
Okay.
He's going to France, I'm going to L.A., and in it's going to be the first time we've ever done this.
And when's that? That's not far, is it?
It's not far. He has to score it, and then he has to send it to musicians.
And then are you, once it's scored, are you looking at, I guess there's no room to rewrite, like, do rewrites. I don't know how it works with scoring stuff, I guess.
Yeah, that we well, they're sight readers. We could change a few things.
Yeah.
But we need to get it down, at least a version they were happy with.
Yeah. It's quite a trip, man, to think... I mean, at no point when you first start a band do you really consider that that's going to be something you're going to be doing a little further down the line.
No. And what's weird is that the decline is a symphony. I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
And Baz, when he didn't talk to me. He just did... He scored it and had a 50-piece orchestra do it in Nancy, France. And I saw it. Someone said, have you seen this?
Well, you weren't even aware it was...
I wasn't aware he was doing it.
That's wild.
And I saw it, and I just started crying. And I wish I had parents to show them, because I was so proud. And, you know, a symphony, it's all new parts, basically. And that's what the decline is.
Yeah.
A couple parts repeat, but it's mostly all new parts. And, that's what this is, and now we decided that NOFX is going to play the decline, and we're going to have either 14 or 28 person orchestra play with us. And some parts we stop and the symphony goes, and some parts we just play the song, and it's so interesting for me, because he'll put a trombone part in, and then I'll rewrite the melody. Like, he knows where to put everything.
Yeah.
And then, but you know, it's my song, so the melodies I kind of got to write. And this kid Baz, he was 23 when he scored this. Now he's 27, so I mean, he's a kid, and he's incredible musician.
How does that feel then to actually, like, that's such a trip. I didn't know it came about like that.
Yeah, he just did it on his own.
Wow.
And then
he's obviously a huge fan then.
Huge fan, and he's a 'cause I'm. a master's degree in jazz drums, and he plays. Yeah. He picked up the clarinet 3 weeks ago and learned it for the Koki, for our Koki shows.
Wow, that's crazy.
And I've never co-written with anybody.
Yeah,
the first person I've co-written with.
How's it feel? I mean, if you're gonna go and start, you might as well start really big.
Well, he knows a lot of things I don't know, and I have a sense of melody that he doesn't have.
But do you think, when you say you don't know, do you think, I mean, you must do intuitively, right?
Well, I don't know how all those instruments work.
Yeah.
I don't understand, like, when you play violin really staccato, when you pluck it, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
You know, I know about songs. So he's like, this part plucked. He goes, blink, 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 blink. And I'm like, oh, cool. And then... Yeah. But I'll, before I even hear the next part, I'll be like, okay, this is the melody. And I'll hum him the melody. He'll put it in. And then I'll do it again, even though the chords changed. And he's like, how'd you know that was going to work? Which is the weird part.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're a great songwriter and you've been doing it long enough, right?
No, but it's not that. It's when I was a little kid, when I was like five, I could add up 5-digit numbers, a whole list of them in my head.
Yeah.
I would just come up with the answer. And then wow. School taught me how to redo math, and I lost the ability to do that. And somehow, about 25 years ago, 20 years ago, music made sense to me. And now it's crazy. Now it's, I hear every part.
So did he work on any of Koki with you?
Yes.
So it was you, Danny?
Yeah, Travis. It's actually Baz wrote most of the drum parts.
Okay.
Not most, from half of them. And then Travis said he wanted to play on it, and Travis came up with a lot of cool shit. And a lot of stuff, Travis is like, I could play that, but I don't want to learn it.
Yeah.
Because Baz is, you know, got a master's degree in jazz drums.
Yeah.
Travis is just an amazing drummer, but yeah. Jazz is a whole different beast. Yeah. And, we got some great musicians on that album.
When I got it, I knew, or I thought I knew, what Koki as this thing was.
No one had any idea.
No, it's tremendous, man. It's so great.
Thank you very much.
And I'm no bullshit. I listened to the record, and it blew my mind, and it really resonated with me, like a lot of the songs. It bummed me out, like a ton. But that's kind of the point, to a certain degree. I think great art should be doing that.
Great
right?
art
should make you
some
feel.
Great art hurts.
Yeah.
I mean, great art it touches people.
Yeah.
And, I've had all these tragedies in my life.
Yeah.
And instead of being metaphoric and, you know, and vague, I just told the stories with song. And, yeah. I like doing original shit, and I've never heard anything like this.
No, me neither. I've played it to so many people. Like, I've played Punk Rock Saved My Life on my show. But to be fair, I think that's probably the only one that I can... No, that's not true, actually. I could play all of it. But it
you
just,
can't...
It
you
just,
can't...
It's so...
There's no genre.
Yeah.
There's no genre. It's just... I'm a depressionist.
Yeah. No. Yeah, that's good. It's so visceral.
Playing it live, we did 3 shows.
How was that?
With an 8-piece band. And it was... I had no idea how taxing it would be.
Yeah.
Emotionally.
Yeah.
Because recording the album wasn't cathartic or therapeutic. It was just a bum out. And I sang all the songs in a corner at Danny from Nine Inch Nails' house.
Yeah.
Sitting in a corner drinking vodka. That was the only way to do it.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? I think a lot of people will be like, oh, to do something that honest and that stark, oh yeah, it must have like a real, like it must be cathartic, but...
It was the opposite.
It's like, that's kind of, to me, and I think that's what makes it so beautiful, is that it's, the honesty of it, and I think it's like dredging up like a lot of stuff.
And it's you know what I think helps it? The details are what really gets people. You know, I heard him hit the floor while I was cooking beans, you know, because that's how sharp it is in my memory.
Yeah.
And that's what really, the details make everything, all great art.
Yeah, for it's, and I think people finding those moments where it resonates with them and like is familiar, and I'm, without wanting to sound like a dick, I'm thankful that I don't, it doesn't all resonate with me. Because it's,
it'd be very few people where every song could resonate with.
Yeah, for sure.
And we had to leave a song off because it's too hard for people to hear. Yeah. And everyone would have concentrated on that song. Well, like the song about killing my mom. Great title, right? That time I killed my mom.
Yeah,
but
that's the thing.
I recorded that a month after she died, which was 12 years ago. 13 years ago. That was cathartic for me because it was so hard to sing and I was crying as I was singing it, and it's such a pretty melody, and it just sat on my computer, and I played it for friends, you know, maybe once a year.
Christmas.
Yeah. Oh. Well, you know, my mom, before she died, she bought me 4 really expensive bottles of port wine and said, I want you to open this and think of me when you're with close friends on special occasions. And that's been wonderful.
Yeah, man.
What a great gift.
That's the one which that made, like, really, that I connected with straight away. I mean, yeah, as you say, the title's amazing. But, like, I lost my mom to cancer in November. So, yeah, it made a lot of sense. And I think how... The thing for me is the whole record, I think, is so beautiful. It's, and, you know, we're talking about it as art, which it is. And it's I can imagine that it's almost like, it's like performance art to a certain degree, to actually, to be able to put those things forward. You know what I mean?
I guess it's performance. It's just...
It's weird because...
It's just peeling off your skin for songs.
Yeah.
I gave up all my secrets.
Yeah, but most people don't do that.
No,
and I
because
think that's only within those kind of worlds that something, you know, you get people like, you know, Tom Waits or Leonard Cohen will write these really beautiful songs.
Stories.
But not like this.
I'm very appreciative that you, like, I'm talking to people that are like, I've never heard anything like this.
Yeah.
And that means so much to me because, you know, you try to make great songs. And I couldn't do these songs with NoFX because people would be like, oh, punk songs. Because I've written depressing songs with NoFX.
Yeah.
Whatever. We're still a punk band. This is a whole new level. And the first song on the album...
That's what I was about to say. The way it starts with Bathtub is just that... Because it's the most stark song on the record as well. And there's so minimalist. The instrumentation, when it first starts, it's like it's almost like a spoken word piece. And it's just like... Straight away,
when the piano hits, you're like,
yeah.
But I opened shows with that song. But I explained, I told the crowd beforehand, I said, these are true stories. This first song is about how I found my wife in a bathtub, and she was trying to kill herself, and I found her just in time. One of the reasons she did that is because I moved her to San Francisco, where none of my friends accepted her, because she was a porn star dominatrix.
Yeah.
And I just stopped getting invited to dinner. And I stopped. It was weird. When I was very social, it all ended.
Yeah.
And the worst thing was Tony Sly from No Easter Name. You know, he died a few years back. I broke up with this woman after 8 years. We separated. And I got invited to Tony Sly's bonfire where they play his songs and sit around on his birthday. I'm like, oh, it's really cool. I'll be there. And my daughter says, yeah, Daddy, we go every year. And I said, they have this every year? I was never invited to it before.
Wow.
Because my wife was a porn star. And
that kind of...
No, it's incredibly heartbreaking because she felt it.
Yeah.
And she resented me that I moved her to a city where she was hated. For nothing, reason.
And you weren't aware that's how it was at the time, no?
I wasn't aware because I didn't cheat on or anything. Me and my first wife married for 18 years.
Yeah.
I never cheated on her. And then I met a new woman Yes, it was soon after, and everybody either was told or thought that I cheated on my wife.
Okay.
But I didn't.
Oh, so it wasn't like a judgment thing in the sense of like, because they were judging of what she did.
It was a lot of that too.
Yeah.
Like,
that sucks.
Eric Melvin, the guitar player in my band, he lived 4 blocks from me for all the time. Hmm. I mean, for years, he's very close. And, you know, I would go over there all the time. And I invited him and his kids and his wife and his dad over. And only he came over with his dad and his sister. And I said, hey, where are the kids? And Eric said, oh, they weren't feeling well. And then his dad pulled me aside, Eric's dad, and said, I got to tell you this, Mike, but Eric has said, I don't let my children over that prostitute's house. Like, what a fucking horrible thing to say. And it's like, I have a daughter. I have a 12, she's 14 now.
Yeah.
And Soma, my wife, she had a 17-year-old. It's like, we're parents, you know, just because we get crazy in the bedroom. And she was a single mom. She made porn. Like, who the... How can you judge us?
Yeah.
Like that. And these are supposed to be punk rockers.
Yeah, that's the thing that I find tough. But then again, you know, you can't hold everybody else to your own standards. Because everybody's different, right?
I do. That's my problem.
Yeah. I mean, that's a natural thing to do. We all do it. But yeah.
I've only slept with 2 women in 30 years. Which is a really hard thing to believe for someone in a band. But because I believe in honor and loyalty, and they were both really good lays. If they weren't good lays, it might be a different story. But, you know, that's why my second wife was a dominatrix. But I had a dungeon with my first wife, too. So.
See, this is the thing that I find, like, super interesting as well, because... Yeah, because it's not a world that I know, and I appreciate it the
BDSM lifestyle.
Yeah, like at what point were you like, yeah, this is my thing? And how?
When I was 11, I think.
Yeah.
Because I was looking at porn magazines my mom had, Penthouse, Hustler, and I hadn't gotten a boner before, and I still didn't. I mean, still, it's like Hustler magazine to me is like National Geographic. A naked woman, who cares? But then I read a story about a man who is submissive to his wife, and she, you know, would, you know, peg him and, you know, beat him and make him. It was an SM story. And I got a boner, and it was the first time I ever jerked off.
Huh.
And it's exactly like discovering you're gay. It is my sexuality.
Yeah.
And people, you know, there's the argument of whether gay is nature or nurture. It's a little bit of both. But my uncle is in the BDSM too.
Ah, okay.
And we didn't know until recently.
That's funny.
And, I, you know, he's my only living relative. And we both, you know, had been to the same dungeons and stuff like that.
No way. That's funny, man.
But, wow. But you know, in the LGBTQT words, they'll never put K, they'll never put kinky, because it's just you like to get tied up. But it's like, no, my sexuality is giving myself up to a woman and worshiping her.
I think because that's the root of everything.
Getting your sexuality, everyone wants to live their dreams. And I finally lost all pride and shame when I was 47, 5 years ago. That's when I started cross-dressing in public. And
how did that feel then when you finally like broke through that?
So amazing. And also it reminded...
Why do you think it took you that long?
Because I was scared. In fact, I wasn't really into cross-dressing, but my first wife, I was wearing a latex maid's outfit, and we kind of got into a fight, and she goes, by the way, you look stupid in women's clothes. And I said... Huh? You know what you just did. You just broke my heart, and you'll never see me in women's clothes again, because you just told me I look stupid, and that's what every guy's fear is to look silly. And I was damaged, and then I got with Soma, and she likes doing that to men. She likes feminizing men, and she did, and I mean she made me beautiful, and. like, once again, I cried because she made me really pretty. And she opened up that world for me. Because Rocky Horror, you know, Rocky Horror was the first record I ever owned. I taped it off my television. It was on Z Channel. And that was, it's been the soundtrack of my life. And that song, Don't Dream It, Be It.
Yeah.
Those words haunted me. They haunted me because I wasn't living my dreams. And now I get to.
And do you think that that's why, like, now, to be as open with everything as you are now, that's, well, I mean, it's testament, isn't it? The album is testament to that, because of that, of how you're living. And I don't mean that to sound like a backhanded compliment, like, in the way that, oh, like, oh, yeah, everything you did before that point. I don't mean it like that. But what I'm saying is, this record is, like, yeah, you have to be that honest with everybody to be able to just...
Yeah, and it's
like that, right?
Yeah, and it's because I don't have any shame, any pride anymore. Of pride in something I make.
Do you think there's shame to be attached to those things, though?
Yeah, I think there's no.
I mean, there is in other people's perception.
Like when you say white pride or nationalism, all that is pride. All that pride is completely unnecessary. Why? How could you be proud of where you were born?
You haven't picked anything.
You haven't done anything. You can be proud of something you made. Proud of your kid.
Yeah.
You know, like I made my daughter take piano lessons. Now she's gonna be singing in my musical Home Street Home. Yeah. She's singing the lead on the record.
Oh, is that who sings on?
Not the first one.
Okay, who's singing on That Time I Killed My Mom? Is that her?
Yeah.
Okay.
She sings that one line.
Yeah.
But on Home Street Home, she's 14 and the lead character is 16, and I recorded her and I couldn't believe how good it was, and I sent it to my producer, not telling him who it was.
Yeah.
Just, I found this 14-year-old girl, she's really good, and he said, I love her, who is she? It's my kid. So that's pride.
Yeah.
Oh, I am proud. I, you know, I made her take piano lessons, and
yeah.
Oh, am I proud. Proud papa.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing, isn't it?
That show, I don't know if you've heard Home Street Home. It's my musical. We opened 4 years in San Francisco, 4 years ago in San Francisco, and we've been working on it. And we got the producer who did Rent and Avenue Q, and he's doing West Side Story right now with Steven Spielberg,
wow.
Kevin McCollum, and we're opening in April at the Pleasance Theatre in London.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. We had a 12-week run there.
Wow.
But if you like Cokie, Home Street Home, it's my best work.
Are you going to be playing shows over here with Cokie as well?
I don't know. It's hard.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
It's better in an intimate scene, but it's not worth it to me to feel that bad. I mean, I'll probably do shows here, but it's, you know.
It's not like I would love to see it, but it's a weird one. Because I don't think it's not going to be an enjoyable night out for anyone. And do you feel like there's a chance of this almost ghoulish appreciation of some of it? You know what I mean?
I don't know. What you've told me is what I hear from most people.
Yeah.
But a lot of people can't listen to it more than once. Because they hear a song that does relate to them and it really hits them hard, they don't want to hear it again. And
that's kind of what I meant earlier when I was saying about performance art. And I don't mean that in the sense that it's not real. Do you know what I mean? I mean in the sense that to put something out there. Like the thing I was thinking about was like at the end of the video for Negative Reel. You're aware. It's a really fucking tough watch.
Yeah.
And I've shown a bunch of people the video as well. I've now, when I've shown it to people, I watch them watching it rather than.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what I mean? It's interesting to see how people deal with something like that.
I didn't know how.
And I don't mean that in like I'm getting a weird enjoyment out of other people feeling uncomfortable. I'm just curious to see how it makes them feel. Because I know how it made me feel. It's like.
How? How did it make you feel?
I had a lot of respect.
You should have seen take one.
Yeah, I heard. I saw that.
No, that, it was that.
You'd done one already.
I done one. And they didn't get. And I kicked the camera over. And that one was longer. And he says, "Mike, you're gonna have to do this again." I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" I mean, because it's not clearly it's not a wood mallet, but it's like a boxing glove, and my face hurt for a week.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But, you know, then again, I hung from hooks.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
How's that? Because this is something I find interesting. Like, my...
That video, pretty cool though, right?
Yeah.
It costs $2,000.
It's amazing.
There you go. It's just me and a cameraman and ideas.
And I like that it's almost got this kind of Dylan-esque vibe with, like, the lyric cards, you know? Like that old Bob Dylan video. But... The thing I find curious about with BDSM is that, like, I'm really interested in a lot of esoteric stuff and a lot of occult stuff, and I know that...
I use that word wrong all the time, esoteric. What do you mean?
Well, things that are, like, you know, things that are... Occult is obviously means things that are hidden, but I guess you could look at it within the world of magic, and I don't mean, like, bunch of flowers pulling like handkerchiefs out of your mouth and stuff, you know.
Like handkerchiefs, you got to tie them in knots and get them pulled out of your ass.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
that reminds me of something. But yeah, no.
What, last night?
I'll tell you a story later.
You know what I do? Like, I make people feel comfortable about their sexuality.
Yeah.
And I all the time people say, "Mike, thanks," because I did. I took sex therapy in college.
Yeah.
It was my minor. And because I'm so comfortable wearing a dress or talking about, you know, getting ass raped by two leather dykes, and I mean, really every fantasy I've ever had, I've done. And how awesome is that?
Yeah, that is awesome.
And they're married to a woman, and they're just too scared to ask her or ask him. Because men, they want it up the ass. They don't want to be with a man necessarily, but they...
I don't know.
Everyone likes a finger. Everybody likes the finger.
The surprise finger.
Oh, yeah, it's a surprise? and people say, "Oh, why couldn't take a cock?" Really? How big was the last turd you took? You know, probably cock size.
Yeah. Coming out and going in is different, though.
No, it's not.
No?
No, the secret... You know, this is funny. Jeff Marks from Avenue Q, he's my co-writer on Home Street Home. And he is a gay guy who did Avenue Q, won Tonys. If you're a Tony-winning gay man, you don't have to take it in the ass. you pretty much, you just got blowjobs. And he goes, I don't take it in the ass. It hurts. I go, "Well, you know how to do it, right?" He's like, "No. What do you mean?" I'm a straight guy who had to teach this gay guy how to take it in the ass, which is you have to push out.
Oh, really?
You push out when it's going in.
It's like having a teeth pulled. They don't pull it, they push.
But your body thinks, "Oh, it's time to go. Open her up," because you're pushing.
Ah.
And then lube slides right in.
Noted.
But I never had a real cock because men are disgusting. And like the money shot, I like to call it cock barf or cock snot because it's so gross. How do people deal with swallowing? Oh! I mean, I can't watch a penis in porn. No way. I do not want any man in porn I watch.
Why? Because you think they're ugly.
Well, we're gross, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny because rubber cocks, love them. But if they're attached to a man, it's... And you know, I would say that because I do anything I want.
Yeah.
I do anything I want.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I mean, I got into this relationship, and there was already a 24/7 live-in slave girl, you know, living there. I couldn't tell what to do.
I find it such a fascinating world. I think it's funny that, pardon the pun, but it's being fetishized now within popular culture.
It's not being fetishized. It's being just accepted.
Do you think so? I guess so.
Well, 50 Shades of Grey is actually, everything in that movie is the opposite of reality. And there's been a new show on.
I just saw Bonding. Yeah, I watched like a few of those the other day.
Unbelievably terrible.
Yeah, but it's like, I guess I would imagine that it's almost like a form of cultural appropriation for the people that have lived that life.
You can make a comedy, but at least they should have hired a dominatrix or something that knew what they're doing, because it's just so false.
Yeah, but then is it like? No, I guess there's funny moments.
I mean, Roseanne, there was an ending of Roseanne where her mother was in all rubber gear and, you know, was going towards this old dude dressed as a dom. And Roseanne is a fetishist.
Oh, okay.
You know, and she got it right. It's like, if you're going to do it, at least get it right.
Yeah.
But that's my biggest passion, you know.
Yeah.
BDSM, more than music.
Well, yeah, I think because that's a deep-rooted thing that's at the core of you. So therefore, everything that you make off, like any art anyone makes is obviously like the sum of the person making it, right?
And that's right.
And if that is such a core thing, such an important thing, you know, that's always going to have precedence. But it's also, I'm interested that now this is the point where it's kind of coming out. Right, in music.
Society's accepting it.
Yeah, but within the stuff you're doing as well, you know. I guess, I mean...
Well, Koki, it's not a big selling record, but all that matters to me, like NoFX is not a popular band on the big scheme of things.
Yeah.
But our fans love us.
Yeah.
And people who heard the Koki album, some hate it, but some people really love it.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters, is touching, really touching some people. If you try to touch everyone with your music, then you're the offspring. You know, you're singing lyrics like, I took her home and I made her dessert. You know?
Yeah.
Not, I grinded up some oxys and shot my mom up with them.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
But, you know, that's what music is. And everyone remembers the records that changed their life. And that's what I'm interested in doing.
Yeah, I think, yeah, like you said, everyone that you know that's heard that record has had
a visceral response to it.
Yeah, I don't think you can't. Do you know what I mean? I don't think you could just listen to it and go, meh.
Well, that's, you know, some punk rockers who think...
But then they're not listening.
No, like some people, Josh from Queens of Stone Age, Josh was like... this is one of the most incredible records I've ever heard. And Fletch from Pennywise was like, if someone doesn't like this record, they're an idiot. But a lot of people don't like it because you have to have some skeletons in your... You have to be a little warped. Well, no, that's not true.
I think you have
to... It's a beautiful record.
It is. It really is. And I think what you need to have is a strong stomach and be prepared to just... look at it in a non-judgmental way and actually and see how beautiful it is.
Well, I mean, it's like my biggest inspiration with the Beatles, as you know, all my music is.
Yeah.
And they're just soft, like songs like Eleanor Rigby. But the lyrics are so dark.
Oh, so tragic. She's leaving home. That song, it gives me the goosebumps every time I think about that song. It's just... is so tragic and like a song that has one narrative, but and they've done it in so well that it shows both sides of it.
Yeah.
You know, like her finally having the freedom and feeling alive and them feeling betrayed. And yeah, it's not easy to do that.
No. Well, you gotta, I gotta play you the home street home stuff. Cause that,
yeah, I'd like to hear that.
It's my best work.
Yeah.
I've been working on it for 20 years. And there's so many songs, and it's everybody in the audience cries and laughs, and it's taken on a roller coaster ride. But it'll be here in April.
Great, I'll definitely come along to that. I'd love to see that.
It's about street kids.
Okay.
You know, and some of them are prostitutes and junkies, but there's no judgment on anyone.
Yeah.
It's about chosen family and how people look down on homeless people. And especially kids, they're in a better place. They're in a better place. They wouldn't have left home, and now they have family. They have they have people that are actually looking out for them.
Yeah, I get that. Like, it's better to have people that care about you and around you and looking out for you, even if the situation on the outside would look fucking dire. But it's exactly right. People don't run away from a beautiful home where they're nurtured and cared for and treated.
My parents were, I mean, I didn't know, like on the Cokie Elm, the hardest line for me to sing was, it's embarrassing, but I never had a birthday party. And that was really embarrassing. That was, I actually admitted that out loud, because it was something that, when you're a kid, you don't know things aren't normal. Like when I go to the racetrack with my grandfather every weekend, that's cool, I'm hanging out at the racetrack. Or I never had a babysitter. You know, I always, since I was like 6 or 7, I was at home by myself at night.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what it is. That's how you live.
Yeah.
But the birthday party thing was weird, because I'd go to so many birthday parties, and I never had one. And I never told anybody that, because it's embarrassing. So for me, that was the hardest line to sing.
Yeah. That's kind of a trip for me to hear. That, like, I get it. For this.
My parents just didn't think of that. Like, I can't throw myself a birthday party when I'm 12. It's up to your parents.
Yeah. You can now, though. But yeah, I know what you're saying.
What do you think of my clothing line?
Nice. I can see your balls.
Oh, see my balls?
Yeah.
Well, but this is my clothing line.
For real?
I have a line called Fat. I'm Fat Mike, so it's Fatal.
Nice.
And it's panties and dresses for men. But you see, the thing is, see the panties?
Yeah.
They're made to be attractive to women. See? It's like burgundy velvet with black trim.
Yeah.
Women don't want to see their man in panties, and men are scared of that.
Yeah.
But these are kind of sexy. I mean, they are, right? Or do you not think so?
Well, it's not my thing, but... But I guess I'm not target audience.
Boy, you're making me feel bad. No, my target audience is actually bros, like Pennywise fans. It is, because...
Do you find now that
we're selling more and more and more and more, because I'm trying to make it acceptable.
Yeah, and are you seeing the kickback from that? Are you seeing people like...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, people...
That's awesome,
they
man.
Send me pictures all the time. Thank you so much, Mike, for making me... Because I've been wanting to do this my whole life.
Yeah.
And you're normalizing it. And
I think there's like,
you know, how that's it makes me feel so good.
Yeah, because I think when you're playing punk rock, and those people are, you know, they're people that are on the fringe, and that is a sense of community, or it should be.
No, punk rock is community.
Yeah.
You ever been to a metal show?
Yeah.
There's no community among metal bands or hip hop bands.
No, I don't know. I disagree to a certain degree. Because maybe if that's not our thing, we're not going to be part of that community.
No, I'm saying, like, the Deftones were the only band that did Ozfest and Warped Tour. And they said it's so different. On Warped Tour, everyone supports each other and hangs out.
Yeah.
On Ozfest, everyone tries to outdo each other, and they each have their own posses.
Yeah,
and they try to out-rock. And maybe some singers will be friends, but there's a non-healthy competitiveness.
Yeah. No, yeah, I see that. That's
like
true.
Punk, you know, Bad Religion played the other night, and I just jumped on the stage, and during a song, I said, "Jay, give me your bass." He goes, "Okay," and gave me his bass, and I finished the song.
That rolls.
You know, it's not like we ask or plan something.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
Like, we don't like to tour with that Bad Religion. Like, on the Warped Tour, we both our bands had a deal. We're not touring without the other band.
That's awesome.
Because, you know, we're old dudes.
I don't know those guys. Like,
nobody does.
Yeah. But
Brian Baker, you know, he's in Minor Threat.
Yeah.
And when he used to party.
And Junkyard.
And Junkyard. And Sam Hain.
Yeah.
And Government Issue.
Have you heard the new thing, Fake Names?
No.
It's good.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's him, Dennis from Refused. One of the guys that was in Girls Against Boys. Yeah, it's really good. I listened to it a while ago. It's wicked. I don't know what's going on with it, but yeah. I've lost track now.
We're on the Punk and Drublet tour. You know what that is?
How's that going? What's the? Because this is something I found interesting, right? Actually, no, I don't even want to talk about it.
Let's not talk about it.
It's silly. About it already. Yeah. Something I do want to talk about is I saw you say something which, again, I didn't even get to say what I was saying about earlier about the sort of occult stuff and how, like, suspensions is like
cleansing,
and a euphoric thing and a consciousness altering thing. And I find it really fascinating that lots of cultures have had those kind of moments where you're trying to transcend.
Well, like, the thing is,
this reality and
what happens is I was going to tap out. Because I wasn't lifted. It was my 50th birthday.
Yeah.
And I had these big high heels on. So they didn't know I was wearing heels. So they couldn't raise me up. I had to jump. I did, like, jump into it. And it hurt so effing bad. And I was like, I'm not doing this. And some guy said, just wait 2 minutes. Just hang on. And then your body releases so many endorphins.
Yeah.
Then I ended up being up for 40 minutes.
Wow.
And it was a really great experience.
I don't know how you feel about these things. Would you say it's like a spiritual experience?
No.
No?
No, it was. And the only reason I liked it is because I said, as soon as I get tied, as soon as I'm hanging, and I was in, you know, the garter belt and high heels.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be tied up with rope as soon as I was hanging. Because if I was naked, just like, you know, hanging Jew meat, I didn't want to look like that. Just hanging fat guy. So they tied my legs up and my arms, and then they put a mirror below me so I could, like, see myself hanging. And it was an incredible experience. Not spiritual.
No? Because I know that a lot of people look at those things. I guess it depends on how you view consciousness and how it gets altered with different substances and different practices, like asphyxia and things like that. And how
a lot of drugs I haven't done.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't try drugs until I was 31. That was, and haven't stopped since. Haven't looked back. Yeah. But I haven't tried, you know, like.
There's
no new drugs and acid.
Yeah.
I don't like that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't even like pot. Slows you down, makes you dumb. Kids, don't do the pot. Really, you know.
Life
advice. Take the amphetamines. Those you get something done at least.
Wow.
But you know, me and my wife never did drugs.
Yeah.
And we're like, hey, we're rich now. Let's do drugs, because we own Fat Records. So why not do it now? Can't get fired. But it'll certainly make your marriage end faster.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that.
Oh.
So here's another thing. I guess that I probably know how you feel about it now knowing when you're saying about it, that not being like a spiritual thing. But something I found interesting was when I saw you say that when you, like, the persona of Koki is like almost put on when you put the makeup on. Is that right? And that you feel like you can be that much more open, not open, but like you can be more sort of transgressive and do things that you wouldn't normally do.
No, not really. When I first wore a pink slip out to dinner in Luxembourg and then played a show in it, and I felt like a punk rocker again.
Yeah.
Because everyone's looking at me, and I'm like, oh, right, I can do whatever I want. I always forget. I can do whatever I want if it doesn't hurt anybody.
Yeah.
And now I do the strangest things in life. Like when I'm in an airport, you know, TSA agents, I always do the circle game with them. Nope, there you go. Got you. And they look, and I punch them. Like, I've gotten four TSA agents in one day. And it's how, like, the universal game.
Yeah, and how they're reacting to that.
They all laugh.
Yeah.
I make people laugh all the time.
Yeah.
Because I have no pride or shame. So when there's some, I'll take the butt of the joke.
That's like a superpower, though, man.
Well,
because that is the one thing, I think the fear of ridicule is the strongest sensor.
Oh.
Because
nobody wants it.
No.
That's why people do not ask for their sexual fantasies, because they're too scared to be ridiculed. And no one will even be honest about what kind of porn they watch, you know? And I do. I mean, I think I'm one of the luckiest people in the world because I met that woman, Soma Snake Oil, and for 7 years of different sex every time. You know, I got tied up in a gondola in Venice. You know, we did a two-hour ride at night. We call it Bondola. But, you know, and I don't think anyone's ever done that before. And I like making history, even if it's just a little piece of history, doing something no one's ever done before.
The reason I ask about the makeup, though, was, like, I get the shtick of it, and I appreciate that. But then I also wonder, because, like, doing these, you know, they're not like the regular interview that I normally get to do for work. I can, you know, we can talk about anything. But I've had conversations with, like, so Jazz Coleman, for example. He was telling me, and he's, you know, he's a very big-brained gentleman. And he was telling me that when he puts, you know, when Killing Joke play and he puts his makeup on, he becomes this other person.
Oh, weird.
Right? And I know a few other people.
You know, they were the first band I ever saw.
Oh, yeah?
Killing Joke in 81 at the Whiskey.
That's not a bad start. I just, like, there's been a couple of other people that I've spoken to, like Maynard from Tool said it as well, that when he was wearing, like weird body paint, where he'd come out and people would be like, oh.
Well, no, yeah, when I get on stage, I feel different.
Yeah.
Because people expect Fat Mike to be funny. And actually, I am funny. I mean, with all this dark stuff, then I'll start juggling.
But you can see that the thing with the record is it is tempered with humor, and it kind of has to be to a certain degree, I think.
Well, it's absurd. Wait.
No, not my mic.
Oh, that was very Blink-182 of me.
I'm glad this is my last interview of the day.
Oh.
I'm not handed that to
that it. That fart was too good. That means I'm going to have to poop pretty soon.
Okay. All right. We can wrap it up.
Well, we can finish this poop in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad you dig the Cokie album. I'm really happy to do interviews for it because it.
Have you been doing many?
I spent like a year doing it.
Have you done many interviews for it so far?
No, I don't do interviews that much.
No? Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. I thank you for. Because the worst thing is when someone doesn't prepare for an interview, and...
Oh, I didn't. This is all me winging it.
I've been doing stand-up and Cokie, so I'm doing comedy and tragedy.
On the same...
No.
Different, I was going to say.
Different things.
Yeah.
And now I know what I want to do. I really want to be a public speaker.
Well, you already are.
I am, but, I mean, no effects were the... We do the most improv of any band, for sure. We taped it once, three nights in a row. We talk for a half hour per set. That's an hour and 15 minutes. So 45 minutes of music, half hour of talking.
Yeah.
And it's never the same. And that's what makes it fun for us.
Yeah, I saw that you said that after all the shit that we won't talk about, but I did see that you said that you were going to do like an album just of on stage banter.
Yeah, you think Vegas is bad?
We tell love.
I said worse things in Vegas that night.
Yeah, I saw that.
It was a hit by the Republican Party.
Yeah,
it absolutely was. All the people on Facebook that said terrible things, they're all friendless. They're all bots.
Yeah,
and you know we got hit hard. That's how it goes. But now I got Punkadelic back in the States.
Yeah,
with Kevin Lyman from the Warped Tour.
Great.
He's my new partner. And
that's awesome.
And punk rockers, a lot of bands didn't want to back me. They didn't. They weren't against me, but everyone was kind of silent.
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? Like when.
No, it's not tough.
Well,
it was an insensitive thing to say.
Yeah.
So what? Bad timing, bad place, and you know I apologized, and I really meant the apology.
Yeah, I think.
I really meant it.
Yeah.
It's, security guards lost 5 friends, but. You know, it's weird as how I got all the shit for it. But I didn't bring it up. Eric Melvin did. I was trying to save him.
Yeah, man.
But, you know,
yeah.
If you're going to talk, I mean, I talk shit every fucking night. And it's going to come back and hit you once in a while.
Yeah, when especially now. Especially now.
Especially now. That's why I'm not stopping. You got to set a standard, a very low standard, and live up to it.
Yeah. That's the perfect finishing point.
Right.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. You know what?
That was a good interview. I hope you thought so, too.
Yeah, I know. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Swim Podcast episode 29. Go and check out the Cokie the Clown record. You're welcome. It's brilliant. I think there might be some dates at some point. I know that NoFX is still doing the Punk and Drublick shows in the US. And yeah, go and find out stuff online. Look at the Fat Records website. Have a look at Mike's Instagram, which is at FatMikeDude. And between those two places, I'm sure you can find everything you need to know. Thank you again to Mike for doing this. I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed doing the painting of Mike as well for the cover of this episode. It's always a bit of a weird one, really, because one of the things which can really hold up an episode is the portrait, because you obviously want to get it right. And sometimes they're a real fight, a real struggle. But I think the one of Mike came out super good. I was really stoked on it. And he seemed to be pretty into it as well, which is nice. You never really want to do a podcast, say, oh, I'm going to paint you for the cover of it, and then send it to someone, and they get it, and they're just bummed out because they think it's dog shit or whatever. It's a real bum out. But yeah, he seemed pretty into it. Remember to please follow the podcast. There's a couple of guests I'm striving for. You may have seen, if you did follow me already, or on my social pages, which is just at Daniel P. Carter, you may have seen that I got a little beggy, and I don't really like doing that sort of thing, but asking people to follow the podcast, because when people are approached, especially when if it's people I know and I go, do you want to come on the podcast? Most of them are like, yeah, of course, because they're aware of it, or we're mates, or they've listened to other episodes and they're stoked on it and they want to be on it. Shout out Randy, that was one of those. But if the social media figures are decent, unfortunately, that can be something that sways people. So yeah, please follow that. If you could leave a review on iTunes, I know it'll take you like 2 minutes just to go, yeah, that was wicked, this is the best podcast ever, 5 stars, big up. That's all you need to do. Won't take very long, and I'll be well chuffed with it. Thanks for listening. I'm out. Peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.